From the studios in the Communication Arts and Sciences Building on the campus of Michigan State University, this is MSU Today. MSU Today is a lively look at MSU-related people, places, events, and attitudes put into focus by Russ White.
Thank you, Lynn. On today's program, the leader of the Michigan Agency for Energy, all the details on the 2016 MSU East Lansing One Book, One Community program, and the MSU alumnus playing Ernie Harwell at Wharton Center this week.
Below, the winter is past. The rain is over and gone. The flowers appear on the earth. The time of the singing of birds has come, and the voice of the turtle is heard in our land. Happy New Year, everybody. Welcome to spring training.
MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR begins at 4:06.
This is MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's Russ White.
MSU alumnus Peter Carey plays legendary Detroit Tigers broadcaster and iconic Michigander Ernie Harwell in Mitch Albom's acclaimed Ernie, now the longest-running play in Detroit theater history. Peter will be playing Ernie at his alma mater when the play comes to MSU's Wharton Center
August 24th through the 27th.
Peter, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, sir.
For the few out there who don't know, and I'm not sure if plot is the right word, but tell us about Ernie.
Well, Mitch did a wonderful job writing it. It's when you're dealing with such an iconic figure such as Ernie Harwell, so beloved and has so many stories in his repertoire, how do you do it? Well, he designed it and wrote it so that it's 9 innings of Ernie's life, and it takes place on his farewell speech, on the night of his farewell speech at Comerica Park in 2009, when he said thank you very much to everybody. And so it's that evening, he's getting ready for his farewell speech, and then all of a sudden this mystical, mysterious boy shows up, and that's his title, Boy. And he coaxes Ernie into telling him his life's broadcast. And you sit there, you go, what? Well, he coaches him and cajoles him into 9 innings of from when Ernie's 8 years old through his childhood, how he got started in broadcasting, and ending up on stage with his final farewell speech.
And what attracted you to this role?
Oh, gosh. Well, I've always been an Ernie Harwell fan, and a friend of mine, an actor friend who's an attorney, was doing the legal work for the play, and he called me up and said, hey, they're looking for an understudy. And he goes, and I know you love Ernie and you can sound like him. And so I went in and read a couple of little paragraphs of copy and of script, and they said, oh, yeah, great. Well, then I get the script, and it's 60-plus pages, and I go, wait a minute. I haven't memorized this much stuff in a long time, so it was a big challenge.
Yeah, can you give me the ear for this, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And Peter, I'm wondering, what are the challenges of playing such an iconic figure as Ernie Harwell, whom so many of us love and are so familiar with, as opposed to playing a fictional character?
Well, that's an excellent question, because Ernie is so loved, you have to respect the man. In some people's minds, the myth, the legend, but you don't do an impersonation of him. You don't do a caricature of him. You channel Ernie Harwell, and if you're true to his belief and how he lived his life, it comes through on stage, and people love it. So you can't make fun of it. You have to be honest, and there are aficionados out there that show up and go, wait a minute. Those shoes aren't right. He would never have tassels on his shoes, and so you change the wardrobe. But we have Ernie's glasses and his iconic Greek fisherman's cap, and it's fun.
And since you've got your own lifelong relationship with Ernie, is there a part of the play that's particularly meaningful to you?
The whole thing is incredible, but I get a special, call it a tingle, because that's Ernie's word, when I talk about seeing, there's a scene where Ernie talks about his first ballpark. And he says, every kid remembers his first ballpark, no matter how old he gets. And then he visualizes his first ballpark. Well, my first ballpark was Tiger Stadium as a kid. And it was Ernie Harwell on the radio, listening to 760.
And Peter, you're engrossed in playing the character, obviously, but have you been able to notice some of the audience reactions? And again, for such a beloved figure, that must be heartwarming as well.
You do feed off the energy of the audience. That's one of the great things about live theater. There's this exchange between actor on stage and audience, even though there's the proverbial fourth wall. It's funny because you have these women that have these big, burly baseball fan husbands weeping on their shoulder, and they're patting them going, it's all right, honey, it's all right, because it's a very emotional play.
Is there something you've learned about Ernie that maybe we didn't know that you could share with us?
I knew he was loved by the public, and that everybody like myself probably had Ernie Harwell stories. But the magnitude of the people this man touched is phenomenal. People come up. I had a lady Sunday night after the show wait around to talk to me, and she goes, I have seen this play 7 times. And she started to tell me a couple of her Ernie Harwell stories when he came to her church, when he came to another women's function that she was at. You don't understand the magnitude of his reach until you interact with all these people.
Peter Carey is my guest. He's playing Ernie Harwell in Mitch Albom's acclaimed Ernie, coming to MSU's Wharton Center August 24 to 27. What about working with the genius that is Mitch Albom?
Oh, he's wonderful to work with because not only does he respect you as an actor, he gives you permission to try things with his content. And it's a mutual collaboration of, okay, let's try this, and then, wow, that works, or, well, not really. So that's the great thing about it. You work through it, and you make it better. And if he sees something that has changed, this is our 5th year, and he made some tweaks this year to lines and things. He said, let's try this.
And, Peter, I mentioned at the top of our conversation that you're an MSU alumnus. Will it be kind of special to play Ernie at your alma mater?
That's an understatement. Oh, my gosh. Now, I don't want to date myself, but back in the 70s, there was no Wharton Center. But it's funny, when I was understudy for Ernie, the young gentleman who played the boy understudy is an MSU theater alumni. He's a theater grad here, and he's telling me all about the wonderful stuff that has taken place. And of course, I continue to visit the campus all the time, and I love what's happened. And Wharton Center, I've seen several productions there. It's a beautiful facility, and I can't believe that I am coming back and I'm going to grace that stage. That's an honor.
And can you tell me a little bit more about your path to MSU back in the 70s and how has this place impacted you, and maybe how it still impacts you?
Well, I'm green and white, and my oldest daughter, she's also in the alumni fold here at MSU. I was here from 74 to 78 and then actually stayed an extra year to do radio because I was at a local commercial station. And something happened in 1979. We won some basketball championship, and I remember standing out in front of Dooley's, and we were celebrating, and I said, oh, my gosh, I have to go to work. So I think I left the celebration at 5:30 and went on the air at 6 o'clock, and the celebration continued. But I was in a production class. Actually, it wasn't even a production class then. I have to go back further. MSU has had a huge impact on me, but more so some of the alumni have. Scott Westerman, Steve Schramm have gone on to great careers, and they started me on my career path, and I'm thankful for them. I was sitting in a psychology class, and Scott Westerman said, "Hey, you know, you got a nice voice. You want to try radio?" Well, he kept on me, and lo and behold, my career path changed from pre-med to the entertainment world.
Well, Peter, you are one of the most successful voiceover and film talents really in Detroit history. I can say that. You don't have to. And you, like you said, you were a DJ on the radio for many years. I'm curious how, with iPods and Pandora and all things like that, how you think the industry has changed most over the years and where you see it headed.
Wow.
I know we could have a three-day conference.
I was
going to
say
that,
but this is more like a weekend conference, but the technology has progressed so much in the last 10 years compared to the 30 years prior, and the rapid pace keeps increasing. You can carry a studio, a full recording studio, digital, unlimited tracks, on your laptop or your iPad now, and I can do it. I can record on the road when I'm on a live tour. Somebody will say, "Well, we've got an audition for you. Can you go to your hotel room and do that?" Before, you'd have to find a studio, and there'd be tape, and there'd be editing, and now you can do that all on even your phone. It's scary. Wonderfully scary, but guess what? They might not need actors soon. We'll all be digital.
No. And I know, Peter Carey, you benefited from and were a big fan of the film incentives that have sadly gone away. Just any thoughts on that?
Well, I don't want to get too political about it, but you look at places that have embraced it, like Georgia. They're building 17 new sound studios, and they can't hire people enough. I know a lot of my really good friends in the industry, crew, gaffers, grips, sound people, cameramen, they're heading down there because they pulled the plug here. So it's sad. But the diehards that have been waving the flag for a long time, myself one of them, we love Michigan, and we want to see it prosper. And so that hurts.
What about with all we've talked about acting and performing on and digital media? What's your advice to the young Spartans or any young people looking to get into this kind of field today?
Excellent question again. Don't give up. You have to, we joke about it, but you have to thrive on rejection. Let's put a little baseball in it here. If you're batting 200 in your auditions in the performance world, you're doing great. I think I get one out of tens of handfuls of auditions that I go on. But when you get them, there's an incredible reward. Don't limit yourself. If you have an opportunity to try something else, do it. Get out of your comfort zone. It sounds cliche, but that's where you find your self-discovery, is when you expand your comfort zone. And next thing you know, it's on your resume, and you can say, "Yeah, I can do that."
I'm talking with Peter Carey, who's Ernie in Mitch Albom's Ernie Harwell. And as we close, Peter, can you maybe give us a favorite line or two as Ernie?
Well, it's wonderful. There are standard Ernie calls that people adore, and they actually cheer when we do them in the play. Ernie is about to sneak out, and the boy doesn't want to let him go yet. And he goes, "Please, please, do some of your calls." And so Ernie goes, "Grounded a trammel over to Whittaker to Evans. That's two for the price of one. Strike three looking. He's called out for excessive window shopping." So we have a lot of fun. And then his iconic verse as he started spring training down in Florida. "For lo, the winter is past, the rain is over and gone, the flowers appear on the earth, the time of the singing of birds has come, and the voice of the turtle is heard in our land. Happy New Year, everybody. Welcome to spring training."
Peter, thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you, sir.
Peter Carey is Ernie Harwell in Mitch Albom's acclaimed Ernie,
coming back to MSU's Wharton Center August 24th through the 27th. There's more information at whartoncenter.com. And I'm Russ White for MSU Today.
This is MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
To Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's Kirk Heinze.
Well, at the recent Governor's Energy Excellence Awards, we caught up with Valerie Brader. Valerie is Michigan's Senior Policy Advisor on Energy and the Executive Director of the Michigan Agency for Energy. She's also been a frequent guest on this program. Valerie, good to see you again.
Great to see you, too.
What about those Energy Excellence Awards? I mean, exciting. The future is bright in Michigan.
It really is, and the amazing impact was there. We heard from Visteon that spent less than $5,000 to get $250,000 a year in savings. We heard about the Innovator of the Year who invented a heat pump that Marine's rural residents can save thousands a year on propane, get it installed in one day at a quarter of the cost. It's really exciting things. And then homeowners who don't even pay electric bills anymore, they've saved so much money. I mean, we are really seeing amazing innovation here in Michigan, from people inventing stuff to installing stuff, and then seeing really how much we do waste. I mean, it's wonderful to celebrate the reductions, but if you can spend $5,000 to save $250,000 a year, more businesses ought to be looking at this.
Well, one hit me personally. You mentioned the personal impact. Geothermal system, that's 25% of the cost of traditional geothermal that hooks right up to your well.
Yeah, that was really invented by someone here in Michigan. And so Michigan homeowners have been some of the first in the country to be able to benefit from that. That's really exciting because it shows that here in Michigan, we can invent things, we can build things, and then they really benefit Michigan residents. It's a really great story.
When we talk about energy, people tend to want to go to the source of that energy, wind, solar, or what have you. People don't talk enough about conservation and wise use.
Yeah, and I think some of it is, well, they're saying, oh, I just have to put on a sweater. And what they don't understand is actually, I can get you a new furnace. You can keep that thermostat the temperature it's always been and spend a lot less and basically waste a lot less energy. That helps our environment. That helps your bills. It helps our overall reliability as a state because we don't need as much. So there are a lot of win-wins out there. And so folks who sort of shy away from doing anything, it's really in their benefit often to get something done.
The pillars we talked about the last time you were on the program, reliability, affordability, protecting the environment. Remind our listeners.
Yeah, so basically we look at everything through a lens of adaptability. What's going to let us be in the best position no matter what the future throws at us? And when you're thinking about that, one of the first things you do is eliminate energy waste. But that's because no matter what other element, what other pillar you're looking at, it's a winner. If you're talking about affordability, this makes your bills lower. If you're talking about reliability, it helps us all not to need that last bit of energy. And then on the protection of the environment, the friendliest thing you can do for the environment is not need to produce anything to feed that need that you had before that now you don't. So that's one of the reasons when we look at things in energy decisions, you have to look at all of those aspects, but energy waste reduction will win every single time. And it's something that can really drive Michigan's energy future.
Well, I know waste reduction is a big one on the agenda for the Michigan Agency for Energy. Let's talk about a few other topics that are swirling around. Renewable energy portfolio, 10% by 2015. We hit that. The governor's talking about maybe 25% or so by 2025. But there are a couple of Senate bills out there that mitigate that. Where are we with renewable energy right now in terms of beyond the 10%? And what about those Senate bills?
So what the governor actually did was look at Michigan's energy future and say, hey, what if we just did what was cheapest? Looking from 2008 to 2025, where would we be? And he said, if you look at reducing energy waste plus renewables, we would be getting between 30 and 40% of our energy from those two sources just by doing what's cheapest. which has really changed a lot of the world. The renewable portfolio standard that you mentioned, you know, we had something in the law that said, hey, it can't cost more than $3. Well, that went away because now it doesn't cost more than the traditional at all for DT and consumers, two of our biggest utilities. So when you're understanding that these old trade-offs, you got to look beyond them and you've got to be able to say, let's make sure that when something makes economic sense and environmental sense and it helps our reliability, we don't have any artificial barriers in the way. We're taking full advantage because the world has changed and we need to make sure that our laws reflect the fact that, hey, that renewable may not be more expensive and that having energy waste reduction up to the max is the right thing to do.
Some, though, are, in terms of some would argue that a mandate was in order to get the 10% and was effective, but a mandate may be needed to get to the 25 or 35 or renewable. I don't think the governor's there with another legislative mandate, but, you know, clarify that for me.
Well, one thing I want to clarify is that you said 25% renewable. The 30 to 40% that the governor's talking about is a combination of renewables and efficiency. So that 30% would be if we didn't have any new renewables. That 40% would be if we filled all of our needs with renewables, and we're probably somewhere in the middle. And what the governor sees is that there are some obstacles in the current law to doing that. There's a limit to how much our electric companies are allowed to spend and how much our gas companies are allowed to spend to do efficiency. Well, that's silly. If it's more cost effective than anything else, why would you limit that? We have a law that says I can give you pre-approval to build a big new plant, but I can't give you pre-approval to build a renewable plant. We have a mandate that was built on the theory that renewables would be more expensive, so you had to mandate that they get built because otherwise things would step in front of them. These are a lot of outdated assumptions that our law has built into it. We need to step back and say, if our laws are creating barriers to the most adaptable future, which is a future that's more protective of the environment, more reliable, and more affordable, then we've got to fix that law.
Let's move to another subject. Enbridge Line 5 has been in the news. The latest development, a couple of contractors have been selected to do the risk assessment. Where's that process?
So we have announced both funding for and selection of contractors to do an independent review for the state of alternatives to that pipeline, as well as any risk of a maximal event, meaning a spill and what it would take to clean that up. We're very eager to get those contracts in place, and we're hoping that we will have those analyses completed in a year. There will be opportunities for public feedback before anything is finalized, and that information is something that we're very eager to get because we think it'll be very valuable to the state.
And you mentioned this, you alluded to it, but it's important for our listeners to know that Enbridge has agreed to pay for those analyses.
They have. They've also agreed that they'll put the money in escrow so that no matter what those reports say, they will end up paying, which is something that really, I think, cements their part of making sure that when we're thinking about alternatives, when we're thinking about risk, it is worthwhile to hire really good professionals to get the right answer. And they were willing to fund it. And they were also willing to give up control over that funding and those reports.
My guest is Valerie Brader. She is the executive director of the Michigan Agency for Energy. Valerie, let's turn to one of your new initiatives recently announced, something called the Clean Energy Manufacturing Roadmap. What's that?
Well, we've gotten a piece of funding that we're really excited about to help a lot of small manufacturers in Michigan take advantage of resources that our national labs provide and really make sure that we're looking at what takes us to that next new manufacturing future that's cleaner, helping to understand what the barriers are and create that roadmap either to remove those barriers or get around them. But we're very excited about the opportunity for some of Michigan's small businesses, especially to be able to interface with a lot of the national labs where there's a big innovation going on. One of our innovators of the year at the Energy Excellence Awards has been getting some DOE funding to work with the national labs to advance his ideas. So we're excited to be able to have that partnership.
So if I'm a small business owner listening to this interview, how do I get hooked up with the roadmap?
You ask the Michigan Agency for Energy how to do that. You can find us online at www.michigan.gov/energy.
And speaking of the Michigan Agency for Energy, when we talked to you last, you had just started in this capacity. It's a bit over a year later. What are a couple other things that you're going to be doing as we look for over the next 4 or 6 months that are at the top of the agenda?
Well, one of the things we're working to do is really look at Michigan's long-term reliability. We don't have a system right now where everyone contributes to our reliability. We now have to import power to meet our minimum reliability standards. And just this, just recently this month, the chair of the Public Service Commission and the Michigan Agency for Energy asked the folks who run our grid, look, if the same thing happened in 2012 when two nukes went down on a real hot day and our grid stayed up, if that happened in 2018 with some of the closures that are predicted not just here in Michigan but also in Illinois, would that still be true? We're asking that now because, number one, if the answer is yes, great. Our safety margin looks good. We can go forward. And if the answer is no, we can both make sure that safety margin gets raised. So the answer is yes, and do some of the things like reduce energy waste, really ramp that up, help people learn about programs that can save them money and help the state for reliability, get those in place. So we're working very closely with the grid operator to talk about Michigan's long-term reliability on a number of fronts and just make sure that we'll have more years like 2012 where something big happens and no one knows it, and fewer years like 2003 when something big happens and everybody noticed.
Well, Valerie, it's always a pleasure. Your answers are succinct, most informative. Great work with the Michigan Agency for Energy. A lot of work ahead of you, but maybe about a year from now we'll get you back on. We love these updates, and Michigan's energy future seems to be glowing exceedingly bright.
We are doing a lot of really exciting things, and we always enjoy talking to you about them.
That was Dr. Kirk Heinze with a sustainability-focused Greening of the Great Lakes segment inside MSU Today here on AM 870 WKAR. To read Kirk's blog and hear more Greening of the Great Lakes content, visit mlive.com/environment. This is MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's Jennifer Orlando.
Migration and refugee issues aren't just fodder for presidential candidates. They're also at the forefront of Michigan State University and East Lansing's 2016 One Book, One Community program. The theme, Faces of Migration, The Human Experiences, features Enrique's journey by Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Sonia Nazario and City of Thorns by Ben Rollins. As a refresher, One Book, One Community is a nationwide program that encourages communities to come together over a common media experience, reading the same book, watching the same video. You get the picture. Each community can determine its own themes and media selections and then choose events and activities surrounding those selections and themes. To talk about the local 2016 book selections, as well as what we can expect for this year's programming, are Kristen Shelley, director of the East Lansing Public Library, and Joelle Brown, program coordinator for the MSU East Lansing One Book, One Community program. Thank you both for joining me.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Migration, that is not an easy topic to unpack. There are a lot of terms and nuances associated with it. So how did you decide upon that as the theme for this year's program? And then how did you decide which books would best capture the migration experience?
Jennifer, you're so right. I mean, capturing the whole idea of immigration and refugees and migration is incredibly difficult, and the whole human experience of it. So when the One Book, One Community committee comes together. We are made up of MSU people and the City of East Lansing staff, and we come together and we meet year-round nonstop, and we discuss all kinds of topics, all kinds of books, and this year we just thought there's so much going on with immigration and refugees specifically that this was an excellent theme. So we kind of came up with some books, and we came up with books on everything from, you know, gun violence to immigration. And we sent out books to our readers like we normally do. And overwhelmingly, the choice was Enrique's Journey. And we had been looking at Enrique's Journey in past years. Other stuff kept coming up that was great, you know, too. So, and more timely. So this year, Enrique's Journey rose to the top, and it is truly timely, as we all know.
One Book, One Community is a way for the MSU freshman class, the incoming class, and the greater East Lansing community to come together over a common experience. So how does this process work, and why is it important to have these common experiences between the campus and city communities?
Really good question, Jennifer. But we need the entire community. We need all of Michigan. We need the entire country talking about these topics. They're important to all of us. I mean, I don't know about you, but one of my grandmothers, I know for sure, was an immigrant. And she, you know, migrated over. And I know that growing up, my mother heard only her mother and her grandmother speaking German in the house. That was it. So I think all of us can find that common theme with immigration and even with refugees. But it's really more of the human story of the journey, and the journey of nobody wants to leave their homeland. It's tragic. It's sad. They all want to go back at some point, but they leave because it's horrific, and they leave because they're trying to find, you know, their relatives here or their mothers. As in Enrique's case, his mother had left Honduras so that she could, you know, send money to the family, and so he left many, many times to try to get here to meet up with his mother. He was a young boy who was missing his mother. And it took him many, many times to get here. And it was horrific. It was horrible, you know, theft, riding on top of trains from Mexico, you know, being beaten, losing money, and then being deported time and time and time again. And this was as a young boy. So, these are things that we need to talk about, of what it means, you know, the humanity of migration with people, and especially with young people, you know, people who are 18, 19, 20 years old, and then pairing them with someone from the community. And that whole conversation about the community, you know, community conversation happens when they're checking library books out, you know, at the desk, and they notice that they're reading like books, or they're in a coffee shop and they both have a copy of Enrique's Journey in their hands. Or, you know, they're standing in line at the kickoff event at the Hannah Community Center. And Ben Rollins' book, City of Thorns, dovetails beautifully into that, because it is about one of the largest refugee camps in Kenya. And it's almost all Somali. And there's over 1 million people in this refugee camp in Dadaab. And, you know, those were set up many, many years ago, just to be temporary, but 1 million people deep, those are true cities now. They're not, they've made cities. And I was very, very fortunate to work with the Somali population very closely in Columbus, Ohio, when I lived there. And many of the people I worked with had lived in Dadaab. And it's not a good place to be. And so, of course, they were looking for a better place. And they were leaving a country that has no government for the most part. You know, the children that I worked with had guns in their arms before they ever saw a book. So that's the type of thing we need to talk about. It's the humanity of it.
So, Kristen, you touched upon a couple of topics that, like you said, a lot of people either experience or know someone close to them that has experienced that. And the emotions are those things that kind of remain consistent. And like you said, the humanity of it is really what brings everyone together. So some great, albeit difficult, topics to talk about, but important ones. We are in the 15th year of the One Book, One Community program here in East Lansing. And how do you keep the book selections and programming fresh and exciting? Joelle?
Yeah, I think it just happens very naturally. As Kristen alluded to, the One Book, One Community committee is made up of MSU representatives, City of East Lansing representatives, and then also community members from East Lansing. And I think the longevity of One Book, One Community, 15 years, speaks to its success, and that it knows the special stuff that makes community building happen around these stories, around these authors, around these books. Every year we just pay attention to relevant topics. We have a committee that loves to read, and so it's very engaged in what is coming up out of publishers. And Kristen is a great resource in what other libraries are using around the country and what has been successful elsewhere in the nation. And so from that, you know, kind of bank of resources, we have to think through some pretty specific things. One would be, is this book both captivating for first-year students at MSU, but also community members in East Lansing? Another is simply the author's availability, but then the author's willingness to both address 8,000 MSU first-year students at the basketball arena at the Breslin Center, but then also feel comfortable, you know, with the community question and answer moderated by the mayor. So it's an all-expansive program, and again, I think that speaks to the 15 years of it. It's such a treasure for the community, and it's really fun to plan. One book, one community. We come up with a theme, we throw it out there, and it's always amazing to see what kind of response we get. For example, every year we have an academic partners meeting for MSU folks who are faculty members or in administration who come together to talk about and brainstorm how to connect the one book theme to their classrooms, to their work. And we have something similar with community members. And it's so fascinating and inspiring to be sitting around that table and to hear from a graphic design professor who can't wait for his students to read the book and create art out of the statistics or the book cover. Really just wonderful things happening in the community. There's this Immigration and Refugee Resource Collaborative that is doing work on immigration and welcoming refugees in the greater Lansing area that has been doing this for many, 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 many years. And it's fun that One Book, One Community gets to highlight their work and gets to, you know, encourage the community to think about this topic and include folks who have been doing this work already into the broader conversation.
So you touched upon it a bit, Joelle, but you're the program coordinator for One Book, One Community. You touched upon some of the events. What else can we expect this year in terms of the author's visits and some of the programming?
So as always, we'll have our kickoff event with Sonia Nazario at the Hanna Community Center. That will be Sunday, August 28th at 7 p.m. Doors open at 6:30, and it's usually a packed house. Doors open at 6:30. Event starts at 7. There will be a portion where Sonia Nazario, the author of Enrique's Journey, will speak, and then there will be a question and answer moderated by East Lansing Mayor Mark Meadows. That will also be live streamed through the MSU alumni website as well. Then the next morning on Monday, August 29th at 9 a.m. is the MSU Academic Welcome at the Breslin Center, and that's when all of those first-year students will come, and Sonia Nazario will address them as well. That is also open to the public, and that event, again, starts at 9 a.m. Then later in September, on Wednesday, September 14th at 7 p.m., the East Lansing Public Library will be hosting a community event with Ben Rollins, who is the author of City of Thorns, and that will be open to the public as well and free, and he will be there to address, you know, his book and then also question and answers as time allows. There are two other really exciting partnerships happening with One Book this year. The first is that the Eli and Edith Broad Art Museum has an exhibition right now by a British artist named Sam Jury, and that exhibition is called To Be Here. And it is a mixed video and sound installation of a refugee camp in Algeria. And so Sam Jury went to that camp and has amazing video and captured some sound. And it really kind of takes the concepts of Ben's book and shows people what it's like to actually be in a situation like a refugee camp. So that is awesome. That exhibition is up now, and it will go until November 27th. And then the artist, Sam Jury, will be in East Lansing and will be giving an education talk at the Broad in the education wing, and that will be September 13th at 7 p.m. Finally, we are very excited to be partnering with the Lansing State Journal on a storytellers event, and that will be September 20th, which is a Tuesday. And the location and further details of that are still being worked out, but the theme will be crossing borders. And so we will, you know, take these topics of immigration, refugee issues, and just the emotional journey of finding a new home, and bring in people who have done that in the local community and really localize those conversations. And it will be an awesome event that I think will be enlightening for people who, you know, have been participating in the entire month-long theme to see what these conversations actually look like on the ground floor in the greater Lansing area.
Well, it sounds like another wonderful year of One Book, One Community programming. Lots of great events coming up, and I'm really excited for the author's visit. So thank you both for sharing. I usually go to the welcome, the kickoff event that day before the academic welcome, and it is a wonderful event. So get there early, as Joelle says. Thank you to Kristen Shelley, director of the East Lansing Library, and Joelle Brown, program coordinator for the MSU East Lansing One Book, One Community program. I really appreciate your time. Thanks for filling us in with such great information. So to learn more about the 2016 One Book, One Community program here in East Lansing, including all the events that Joelle mentioned happening here on campus and around the community, you can visit www.onebookeastlansing.com. For MSU Today, I'm Jennifer Orlando.
This is MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
Of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's Kirk Heinze.
Well, here to talk to us in general about the Calhoun County Trails Alliance, and more specifically about a bold countywide non-motorized trails plan, we have Dr. Mark Lilly, an Albion, Michigan-based evaluation consultant, and Albion College senior Danielle Nelson. Mark, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Kirk. Good to be here.
Danielle, always great to have students in the studio.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Mark, let's start here with this, with the importance of the alliance. First of all, I think you call it the Calhoun County Trails Alliance. It's been going on for some time, but things are starting to really ramp up. Give us some background.
We've been in existence for about 15 years, and we've been doing a lot of planning and fund development to construct the trail across Calhoun County. And it's important because Calhoun County is the nexus of about three or four major trail systems. The longest is the North Country National Scenic Trail that goes from North Dakota to New York. It passes through Calhoun County. The Governor's Iron Bell Trail also passes through Calhoun County, as does the Great Lake to Lake Trail. So we need to finish the 40-some-odd miles left in Calhoun County to connect all of these trails.
Now, for our listeners who may not be familiar with Calhoun County, what cities and municipalities are we talking about, and how much trailway do you already have?
We have about 6 miles of new trail that we just constructed in the last year, and there's only about a half-mile gap between that and the Battle Creek Linear Park, which is another 20-some-odd miles of trail. So it stretches the communities that this trail would connect are Battle Creek, Marshall, Albion, Homer, and then ultimately to connect to the Falling Waters Trail in Concord, which is already constructed.
So give us some snapshot of the trails as they exist. Are they paved? Are they gravel? Are they a combination? Are they bike? Are they equine? A little bit of a snapshot of what the trails are used for and what they look like.
Ultimately, we would love to have equine, but at this point, we have not been able to do that. But with the Albion College Equestrian Center and the Calhoun County Fairgrounds in Marshall, that would be a great opportunity to connect those two equine facilities. The current trail is a combination of paved and crushed limestone. Through the Ott Preserve in outside of Battle Creek, it's a nature preserve, and that is all crushed limestone just for environmental reasons. But we're trying to do paved where we can because actually in hilly terrain, paved trail is better on the environment because you don't get a lot of erosion and runoff.
Mark, I know you do a lot of evaluation work and consulting. You do some economic development work as well. You used to be with the Kellogg Foundation. What kind of an impact would this trail, or is it having and will it have, on the county from an economic standpoint?
It's already having an impact that a lot of people don't see. There's a bed and breakfast in Albion Heritage Inn. They get people staying at the bed and breakfast who are hiking the North Country Trail from New York to North Dakota. You see bikers coming through Albion all the time. When I was with the Kellogg Foundation, we funded the Kalamazoo River Valley Trail. The economic impact of trails in Kalamazoo County has been phenomenal. They have billboards along I-94 because young people want to live in a vibrant place that has recreational amenities like trails. So the segment in Calhoun County is not where it ultimately will be, but we're already starting to see some benefits.
Danielle Nelson, it's always a pleasure having students in the studio. And one thing we've learned over the past 7 years, a lot of sustainability initiatives and innovation are coming from students these days. Tell our listeners how you got involved in all of this in your tenure at Albion College.
All right. A little bit of a long story, I guess. I'll try to make it short. But I basically was doing an internship for the city manager in Albion, Cheryl Mitchell. And she is fantastic and very progressive. And one of the initiatives that she had me work on was trying to make Albion a biking-friendly town. It's a small enough town where you really can reach everything by walking and biking, but our connections aren't that great throughout the town. The infrastructure isn't necessarily there. And so from there, that led to us applying for a DNR Trust Fund grant, and we ended up getting it. And we'll be starting construction this fall on a new section of trail that will connect all of this, continue to make the connections from Albion to Homer along all these trailways that Mark mentioned. And with that, though, we've been more aggressively pursuing a trail town designation. And once the state actually has criteria that will lead to that certification program, we'll be pursuing that. And we're kind of in the works right now of doing that. And with that, though, too, with my interest in trails, and also I enjoy hiking and whatnot. So so Mark actually encouraged me to join the Calhoun County Trailway Alliance Board. And so I did get involved in that in October of last year, I believe, is when I joined on. And with that, it's been a really great experience to be more involved in the back, the kind of behind the scenes work that actually goes into constructing these trails, planning for them, and a lot of the advocacy work that goes into it as well.
Yeah, I wanted to mention, you did, that you're both board members, and you became a board member after you got involved in your internship project. In terms of the grant writing from the DNR, I know I remember reading some things, but you had a pretty tight window to get some grant application in there, and you had to get some people mobilized pretty quickly, as only students can do.
yes, definitely. It was really was just a matter of getting everyone in the same room at the right time, and we had about 30 days before the deadline until, when we got everyone together is when we kind of found out about this and scheduled the meeting. And luckily, we just had everyone there at the right place in the right time, the Calhoun County Trailway Alliance, Michigan Trails and Greenways Alliance, as well as a staff at the college, Greg Strand, who has been incredibly supportive and helpful with this. He also is at the Planning Commission for Albion as well, and so he was very instrumental in putting that grant application together quickly. And so we had about 30 days to get it done. We got it done. And then later that summer, they came out to kind of take a look at it, and it's a really exciting trail project. So we were very lucky to have what we have in Albion in terms of the scenic beauty and the Kalamazoo River. So it really was a great project to come together on.
My guests are Danielle Nelson, she's a senior at Albion College, and Dr. Mark Lully, who is an evaluation consultant based in Albion. Mark, let's come back to you for a moment. A lot of things are underway. Some trails have been developed. Some grants have been secured. What are some immediate next steps?
Everybody wants to know where the trail's going next. And so do we, frankly. Some counties are blessed with lots of rail corridors that are abandoned and where the ownership hasn't reverted. Calhoun County is not like that. We have many challenges. We have two interstates that we have to go under or over, I-94 and I-69. We have the Kalamazoo River to cross. And so all of those factors dictate where we're putting the trail, and we don't know. We're in the planning phases right now. The engineering phase, we've had a consultant helping us plan some alternative routes. So what we need now is we're working on funding to do the detailed engineering study.
One thing, we've had trails as a focus on this program before, but you're dealing with so many different constituencies when you're building these trails. You have public property. You have private property. You mentioned the Kalamazoo River. You have rights of way. You really got to get a team together to get this stuff done.
You absolutely have to have a good team together. And what we found, and this is true in trails across the country, is landowners are concerned about privacy and trespassing, littering. And so they may be skeptical up front, but once the trail goes in, the people who live next to a trail find their property values go up. They use the trail. They're not the issues that people are concerned about up front. So it tends to be the situation where when you build the trail, people get enthusiastic about it and see the potential for it.
Danielle, let's give you the last word here. We hear a lot about the Renaissance going on in Detroit and other communities, but now let's talk a little bit about Albion and Battle Creek and Homer and communities like that. I mean, where is this going from your perspective, and how are is this trails plan feeding into it?
I think so. Urban revitalization is something that really is of interest to me. That's what I would eventually like to go on to study further. And, you know, in some of these post-industrial towns, we have a lot of areas that are just difficult to redevelop. And so cities like Albion and Battle Creek and Homer, you know, as we move forward with these trails, I think that it's a really great way to draw new people in. Particularly young people are really liking to have these amenities there. And not only that, I find that it's a great way to improve public health. I mean, getting people out, it's a great community building tool. And so really being able to find a new niche for communities that so long identified with that industrial town, being able to maybe shift that focus back to some of the things that were already existing in terms of the natural resources and being able to celebrate those, I think that that has become a really great economic development tool, community development tool, and especially when it comes to community building and kind of those the intangible things, trying to build up that community spirit again. I think that the trails are a great way to do that.
My guests have been Danielle Nelson, an Albion College senior majoring in economics and public policy, and Dr. Mark Lilly, an Albion, Michigan-based evaluation consultant. Thank you both for being on Greening the Great Lakes.
Thank you very much for having us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
That was Dr. Kirk Heinze with a sustainability-focused Greening of the Great Lakes segment inside MSU Today here on AM 870 WKAR. To read Kirk's blog and hear more Greening of the Great Lakes content, visit mlive.com/environment. Sundays at 4 o'clock, it's MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. MSU Today is a lively look at MSU-related people, places, events, and attitudes put into focus through conversations by MSU President Simon, Spartans A.D. Hollis, sustainability-focused Dr. Kirk Heinze, and me. MSU Today every Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock on AM 870 WKAR.
Hi, I'm Kirk Heinze, host of the sustainability-focused Greening of the Great Lakes program. Our major goal is to help answer one of the great questions of our time. How can we leave this planet richer in life and possibility for future generations? From subjects like alternative energy, climate change, biodiversity, and cultural preservation, we ask leaders in industry, academia, and the government about the key relationships between environmental, economic, and social sustainability. How do these areas support one another as we work to improve our world? Please join me for Greening of the Great Lakes and visit us online at greeningofthegreatlakes.com.
Thank you for listening to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. To hear this show again, click on the radio tab at WKAR.org and scroll to MSU Today every Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock on AM 870 WKAR.